From our studios in downtown Portland, Oregon, this is a Coin6 digital exclusive.
So joining me on our Writer's Block podcast today from the Pacific Northwest, well, I guess a Pacific Northwest transplant, Jen Longo. She lives in Bainbridge, Washington, and her new novel coming out January 21st. It's called What I Carry. Thanks for being on with us today.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for having me. This is a thrill.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know. I was reading that you don't like, I saw you tweeted about, was it public speaking or you're doing some sort of TV interview and you're really nervous. So I was glad you agreed to do this.
Makes me so nervous. And I won't listen to this later because my voice is, you know. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, believe me, I'm the same way about mine. And I work in TV, so that's that's no good. So I do want to talk about your new novel that's coming out, which involves the foster care system and also the other novels that you've written. But first, I want to just give our listeners an idea of your background, because it's super fascinating. I guess you've always been in the sort of world, but you started off really with an emphasis on acting. Is that right?
Yeah, my entire background is mostly in theater, and I graduated with a degree in acting, but I always wrote, you know, just wrote in journals and constantly read, and I loved English and mm-hmm. wrote plays and stories, but I never felt like, I think a lot of it is because in English classes, mostly you just read books and things by white men, and right. I think subliminally, it just never occurred to me, I don't know.
Yeah.
It never occurred to me that that was a thing that I could do, and I loved acting so much. And then when I got to grad school, I realized the thing I loved the most were the scripts and the writing, and I started taking playwriting classes, and I changed my major and graduated with a master's degree in playwriting.
And that's in San Francisco? Is that where you're from?
Yeah, in San Francisco, that's where I got a degree in acting, and then I did graduate school at Humboldt State.
Oh, okay. And you got this master's, and it looks like you actually wrote at least one play that was on the stage called Frozen. Is that right?
Yeah, I wrote a lot of plays, and hardly any of them got. It's really hard to be a playwright.
Yeah.
It's harder, I think, than getting
a book published.
I mean, for at least for me, which is, oh, God, there's a million people right now going, oh, jeez. How can you say that? It's really hard, you know, to do both. But I honestly think that playwriting is just a smaller. It's an amazing thing to write a play, and it's a miracle to get one produced.
Yeah, well, and the book I was looking over just some background on you last night on my Chromebook at home, and my 10-year-old walked in, and I had it up where it said that you'd written this play called Frozen, and she, of course, immediately thought Frozen, you know, the Disney. And I'm like, no. This is not like I read her the synopsis. So it seems like you take an interesting take on things with some of the plays that you have written.
Yeah, I'm always really interested in sort of disparate things that end up linking thematically. I was so mad when Frozen came out, but I became really interested in the Age of Exploration in Antarctica and Ernest yeah. Shackleton, particularly his exploration of and his famous journey to Antarctica, one of them, that just and the just the impossible resilience that it took to get his crew out, and I wrote this play that was produced as a graduate student about that, and I wrote another play about a girl living in a cemetery in grad school. And so those two became my first two novels. They began as play scripts.
Oh, okay. Well, and so at least, you know, even if they didn't make it to New York or whatever, they're living on through your books, right?
Exactly. Scripts, and I think some small companies do them once in a while.
Yeah. Oh, that's fun. Well, and some of them, haven't you set some to like music, or doesn't one of them have a jazz twist or an 80s twist? I'm trying to remember.
Oh, that was one. So there's a theater company I've worked with for 25 years at my family in Sacramento, and I've started writing updated versions of Shakespeare plays. And so we did do, my dad had started, he was the artistic director, and he'd written a jazz age, begun a jazz age retelling of Taming of the Shrew, and then he passed away, and I finished the script for him, and now we're working on an 80s rock version of Hamlet, which
oh
will
gosh.
Be done, I think, in 2021.
Oh, I love it. Where can we see that? Is that one of those things where you write it and you don't know what's going to happen?
No. So I wrote it, and the Shrew was the Jazz Age Taming of the Shrew, and they're being produced. That was produced a couple years ago, and the Hamlet will be, you know, in a couple of years, and they're in Fair Oaks, California, near Sacramento.
Oh, okay.
At the Fair Oaks.
Oh, at there.
At the Fair Oaks Theater Festival.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I'll have to venture down, because that does sound amazing. So you.
They're pretty great. They've got some amazing actors and musicians that work there.
Yeah, and so you were doing all of this, but then when did you decide that you did want to maybe take a turn in the direction of writing novels?
When my daughter was like 3 and she started going to preschool, and I had stopped working as a literary assistant at the Magic Theater. I was getting frustrated, and I was trying to get these plays produced, and I thought I should try to get them into long form prose just to see, because plays are hard. You know, you have an hour and a half, 2 hours on stage, and there's a lot. It's all dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always loved books, and I've always wanted to write books and been afraid. But I thought, I'm going to see if I can take, you know, you can go so much deeper into inner thoughts and monologues and travel places in a novel that are different than in a play. And I wanted to see if I could try and do that. So I started writing the novel version of the play that I wrote based on my life. My parents owned our town cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to keep those disparate themes of one way to learn to really live life is to find the beauty in death.
Yeah.
So I started going into it probably with a lot of self-therapy.
Yeah.
Write stuff about my family. A bunch of crap about them, which I'm sure they didn't appreciate. But
I was wondering about your fascination with cemeteries. So this, you did pull that then from your own life.
Yeah, my parents in fifth grade, a classmate died in a really awful, well, it's never a non-awful way, but, you know, 10-year-old girl. So our classmate passed away, and a few months later, my parents bought the cemetery where she was. I would go to the cemetery all the time to kind of see her and hang out. And it was, you know, it's a weird thing when you're 10 and someone your age dies.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents bought that cemetery. So we all started working there. And we didn't live in the cemetery, but it was, you know, it was a weird thing. And I was terrified of death and scared of it, but it was kind of forced on, you know, my sisters and I to kind of deal with it. And I became friends with our grave digger, and it was a whole bunch of nonsense. It was crazy.
Yeah, but hey, it gave you some great material, right?
Such good material. Oh, my God. Such good material.
And so, and you basically, it sounds like you were doing the opposite of, you know, you hear of people doing these adapted screenplays, like they're taking a book and making it into a movie, but you're taking a play that you've written and making it into a book. And so that this is your debut novel, 6 Feet Over It. So it sounds like you drew a lot of that then from your childhood and just experiences that you had.
Yeah, and it was really the agent that I have, Melissa White, who's at Folio, what an angel to take this book, because even though it was structurally a mess, because I am so used to writing plays, there's things that you can change the plot, you can fix the plot, you know, you can fix the structure. What you can't fix is the voice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're reading a book and there's a narrative whose voice, it's kind of a woo-woo way to talk about it. But, you know, when there's just a voice that really grabs you, she thought that there. And so if you've got, that's the thing that you can't really teach, you can't really force and create. So if you have that, she was willing to, God bless that woman. She went through so many revisions with me, and then my editors went through them, and we found a way to take, because like I said, you know, plays are all dialogue.
Well, and I was going to ask you that because, you know, like I can write dialogue pretty well, but writing a novel, you have to fill in like with the description.
Yeah.
How was that difficult for you to learn how to do that? I mean, it was a totally different style of writing.
It was awful. I had to cut like 2/3 of the dialogue out. They're like, nobody wants to sit and read 5 pages of dialogue. And what's with all these descriptions of weather? I was like, I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing.
Right, but you had a strong voice, so they like that.
Yeah, they thought, and you know, everyone's got their strengths, and some people. people are like, oh, God, I can't do dialogue. And I said, just let me write your dialogue. You write my everything else. And then we'll write a book together.
Right.
So eventually we figured it out. But the other book, the book about Antarctica and ballet started, I wanted to write a play about photography.
Uh-huh.
And when I went to the Kodak website, this was in the late 90s, the Kodak website was all about, there was like a, oh God, was it the 70s, there was some anniversary of Ernest Shackleton's trip to Antarctica because his ship photographer had all the plate glass negatives where I guess Kodak has possession, or they were Kodak, and so all these photographs, and I became more interested in that. And it just in the photography, and somehow that became the just idea of surviving something so insurmountable became really inextricably linked with ballet to me, with the struggle I've been doing with writing a book about ballet as well. And Antarctica and ballet are so much alike. And
are
I found
really?
A way with my editor's help to link those two.
Yeah,
and
no,
make
wait.
A story about that.
Did you have experience with ballet as a child?
Yes, I did ballet from ages of 8 to 18.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing where when you're about, you know, 13, 14 years old, that is when you have to decide if you're either going to put your whole life into
right.
it or it's just going to be something fun for you. And I didn't have I had the love and the desire to, but my body was not. It's a really specific thing. It's a mathematic equation that your torso and your neck and everything mm-hmm. have to be certain measurements. And, you know, and if that's not there, it's not going to happen. Also, I probably wasn't that great, but I loved it.
Yeah.
So it was, but it's devastating to, you know, put your whole life into it. And then when that ends, then you're like, well, that,
Yeah.
Now what do I do? And that's where the resilience comes in.
Well, but again, it gave you some good material to draw from in your life. So the second novel that you're referencing is Up to This Point. Point
yes.
with an E at the end. Am I pronouncing that right, or should it be? Is there some ballet? Okay.
Oh, no.
Make sure. The minute I said it, I'm like, is it Ponte?
Exactly. It's very French.
Yeah, very
French. My editor comes up with all my titles. I'm not good at titling, so they do it.
Oh, I love the artwork on your covers, too. It just looks so cool. And so that.
That's Noelle Stevenson. She does the She-Ra cartoon. She is
oh, my gosh.
She did the Lumberjanes.
The She-Ra, is there a revived She-Ra cartoon?
Yes, and Noelle Stevenson's doing it, and it's amazing. It's beautiful, and I couldn't believe that they somehow got her to do those covers. I mean, she's incredible, and they're beautiful, and I was so proud.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'll have to check out, because I watched She-Ra coming up as a, you know, in the 80s, and we tried to watch either that or He-Man. I get them mixed up. They're on Netflix, like the old ones. We tried to watch it recently, and I was like, these do not hold up. these are pretty
good.
Terrible.
The new ones are just this total feminist, like, beautiful, awesome thing, which, of course, is making a lot of boys angry, but she's like, you know what? This isn't for you. So go watch.
It's not for no. She-Ra is not for them. She's not some sex symbol. That's not. Yeah, no. I'm glad.
Yeah.
That's good. Okay. Well, that's good to know. That little side note. But tell us about just the plot of Up to This Point, because it is. You said, you know, ballet and Antarctica have so much in common, and I'm like, they do. I would never have put those two together. So how did you weave those two things into this story?
That was a rough pitch meeting, I got to tell you. That
I can imagine.
Call wasn't good. So the thing about ballet is that you do it or you don't if you're going to be professional, and you give up everything and it still might work out. And that is the same idea with going to Antarctica. You just have to hope that it works out. These guys would get in their ships and they would go there and they would plan mathematically how they were going to get to the South Pole, and they would bring these sleds with food and supplies and dogs, and they would do it to the point where they had the dogs pulling the sleds and they had food for the people. And as the food diminished, the weight of the sled was less, and so the dogs had less to carry. They didn't need as many, and so they would then eat the dogs. So they would have food to eat,
mm-hmm.
and they also wouldn't have to carry it. It's sacrifices like that and things like that where if, you know, you want to be a ballerina, you're not, it's like any professional, you know, like career athlete, you're not going to have friends. You're going to destroy your feet and your body's going to be broken by the time you're 30. Mm-hmm. But you're going to have this glory and you might die, but it's worth it. And in order to do it, you have to be willing to eat your dogs either mm-hmm. way.
Well, there's an analogy right there.
It's not really cheerful, but you got to do it or...
I can see the ballet instructor. Ladies, you have to either be willing to eat your dog or die. these little 5-year-old girls in their tutus.
You don't talk about that in fame. Everybody opening a fame. You're going to pay in advance, and it's going to start here.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, God, I haven't seen that show in a very long time. And so in the book, then, the character, her ballet dreams don't work out, and then she travels to Antarctica. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, that's it. She basically gets to the point that I got and that a lot of girls get, where it comes to the time where you can either be professional or not, and it's not going to happen for her. And her best friend, sadly, it is happening. Not only is she a wonderful dancer, but her body is built for it. And she's like, well, now, because I see a lot of my daughter is 17, and there's a lot of, that's just a hard age. Resilience is one of the best things that you can have, because we're all going to get disappointed. And this whole thing where we tell kids you can do anything you want, well, you can't really. Mm-hmm. That is a lie. You yeah. can't, I believe, that you can't just tell people, you know, it's ballet, it's Antarctica. Yes, a lot of people, Scott was an explorer who was, you know, I can do anything, I've planned it all out, and he died, and everybody died. And so telling our kids that they do that, and then it doesn't work out, their thing, and then they're just like mystified and confused.
Crushed.
Like, what? But you said I could do anything, and I worked as hard as I could. And that's the character in the book. She does everything right. She eats what she's supposed to. She has no friends. She's killing herself at school to graduate early. She goes to, you know, 5 hours of classes a day, but it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can do it right, and it doesn't. And so I like that she has a connection. She's related to one of the explorers that was at the turn of the century trying to get to the South Pole, and so she gets into this science thing and just loses her everything. She has no sense of purpose, and then so she goes to a place that's completely ice, and there are no trails in the ice. There's no footprints. There's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And she kind of finds her way back that way by surviving
it. Sounds like, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, that does sound like a hard pitch for sure, but it does sound like it's got a good message to it.
It worked. Somehow we made it work. Again, amazing editors who were like, listen, here's how you write a plot.
Right. Well, what I like is that you're one of these authors that seems to be able to write about like one novel to the next. They're just completely different. You know, they're all like different settings, different topics. I mean, they all seem so different to me. Because I was looking at some blurbs for your new novel that's coming out this month called What I Carry, and that involves the foster care system. So, I mean, it's just, again, like a just totally different subject. So do you have experience with the foster care system or, you know, firsthand knowledge of what goes on with it?
I do. We fostered our daughter. We met her when she was a year old, and we fostered her for over a year, and then we were able to adopt her.
Oh, awesome.
And as I hesitate to say I have firsthand experience, because I was never...
Right.
Sorry?
But you worked, you know, your daughter. So,
yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. But I feel bad saying, like, because I was never in foster care, but that is my experience, is that we adopted our daughter. So then as she got older, and she's a big reader too, and we'd go to the library, and there's not a lot of books. She likes contemporary fiction, and there's some amazing ones about kids in foster care. There's not a ton, and what she was saying as she got older was, can we just have a book about foster care that is a little less yelly and a little less molesty and a little less like it's not always this horrible, awful thing.
Yeah.
And then I had a friend one time, we were talking about a mutual family who had a teenage kid that they were fostering. And the kid was acting out completely understandably. This kid was angry and had a really crappy life so far. And this friend of mine was like, yeah, well, that kid's just not grateful enough. That kid just doesn't know how good he has it. And I, in that moment, I was like, yeah, Okay.
Yeah.
I need to write a book about this because there are a lot of people, I am shocked continually daily, who do not understand that kids are in foster care because of nothing that they did.
Right.
Because
right.
of the actions of the yeah. adults in their lives, whether it's their family, their guardian, or the government, or the foster care system itself, the adults are making situations where kids are then placed in foster care, mm-hmm. and then people act like it's juvie. They think the kids have done something wrong, yeah. and that's why they're in care, and they tell their kids that, and there's this weird myth. These are just human beings in a really horrible situation going through trauma, and then they're getting pinned and painted as that they're bad somehow. And I just, the more people I talk to, grown adults who think this,
yeah,
who think these lies about the kids,
yeah.
and the problem is no one listens to the kids. People listen to the adults who go around talking about how life is hard for them. Oh, it's hard to be a foster parent. It's hard to be a birth parent. It's hard to, you know, oh my God, I just want them all to shut up and listen to the kids. And so for this book, I listened only to kids. I talked to and listened to and interviewed and emailed kids currently in or have aged out, who have aged out of foster care. And mm-hmm. the stuff they told me was not what you get from adults.
Hmm.
It just isn't the reality of it. And so I'm hoping that this book, you know, if parents aren't going to raise their kids to understand that there's other kinds of families, like the stuff that kids would say to my daughter,
mm-hmm.
like what are their parents just not explaining to them?
What,
you know,
is.
What is foster care and what is adoption? They just don't. So one way, if our parents aren't going to raise us to learn about other people's families, maybe we can read books. And so I hope that this book can be, you know, a good story, obviously, and fun and funny and sad and sweet, but also, you know, there's some stuff in there.
Just some eye-opening.
Some things I've learned from kids in foster care that I hope come through.
Yeah, and so what is the plot of this? Is it told kind of from a child going through the foster care system?
Yeah, it's a first-person narrative of a girl. A lot of it is about aging out of foster care specifically. So it's a first-person narrative of a girl who is in her last year of foster care. And this is also a really rare situation that she is a lifer. She was born into foster care, never adopted, and now she's aging out. And there's reasons for that explored in the book. And the narrator stresses a lot that this is definitely not, you know, indicative of every single experience in foster care is different. But this character is a lifer. There's reasons she hasn't been adopted. And she's got this notion that, oh God, when I age out, I will be free and I'll be out of this. And the reality of what aging out is, you know, kind of dawns on her. And there are flashback memories detailing some of the 20 placements that she's had. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted it to be, my daughter's like, can there be a happy ending? Can there just, and I understand that's like a classic thing. Oh, an orphan finds her, you know,
right.
forever family. And but sometimes there's nothing wrong with that. Sometimes there are happy, you know, foster care, it is just a different family. And there are
yeah.
some really decent people as well as some, you know, that's the other thing. Foster care gets this horrible rap, like if, oh God, your kid's in foster care, what a nightmare. You know, it's not all, everyone's getting houses burned down and molested. It's not always that.
Right.
There are people working hard and there are just these kids working incredibly hard to survive mm-hmm. and make it. So this is a girl who's aging out and she's kind of dropped her from kind of a mess of a childhood into a really idyllic, kind, loving place, and she doesn't know what to do with it.
Hmm.
It's really confusing to her.
Yeah.
And the idea of permanence is very scary to her.
Because she's never had it
before. So that's
what
that's about.
Yeah. Well, it sounds definitely interesting. I know, and I know this was based on a true story. I watched that movie Instant Family recently. I'm sure you've probably seen it with Rose Byrne. And I think it's Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah.
And they play, it's based on a real life foster family, but they take in these older kids who were just passed over.
Yeah, sibling set, right?
Passed over, yes. Oh my God. And that has a happy ending. The movie has a happy ending. And I bawled like on and off throughout that entire movie because you see what these kids go through and what the family goes through if they're trying to adopt and. you know, it's just the system is so much red tape. And yeah, it's definitely a good issue to you know, make accessible to people, maybe on the level of like a novel that they can read, like what your daughter was saying.
Yeah,
like, can I just have something?
I hope so. And like I said, I only listen to kids' perspective, and yeah. The adults have had their chance. They're the ones that control the narrative, and when they control it, they can make it pretty untrue. There's a lot of sort of saviorism in the community of people who want to foster and adopt kids, and they always talk about how hard it is for them. I think, oh my God, shut up. You're an adult. You're not guaranteed or owed a child, but yeah. Every child born deserves at least one good parent.
Right.
And they've got this idea that they're just going to rescue and save these kids, and that's where the attitude of, oh, they're just not grateful enough comes in, you know? So
yeah.
I just wanted to try to make sure with this book that that's clear, that no one's there to save anyone. These are kids who need help, and it's not about saving them. It's about, you know, being willing, one of my favorite people, to do the work, to create a relationship. Some of these kids just want to go home to their birth families.
Yeah.
As bad as it could be, or maybe as not bad. And it's, yeah, it's a really confusing. And then, of course, my editors had me throw in the sort of Antarctica graveyard aspect of the themes, of the heavily referenced John Muir. I have this character is given a book, one of a collection of John Muir's writings when she's little, and this is sort of where she gets this. Well, John Muir was by himself out in the wilderness. He lived outside like 80% of the
yeah.
time. And his whole thing was, if you're out under the stars at night, then you're home, because all of us live under the stars. And even though she's going from, you know, 20 different houses in her life, she gets outside and she starts walking and she clings to his words. And she, so that's a really fun aspect
yeah.
of her dependence on him.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it sounds like it's going to be really good. Are you doing any appearances in Oregon? I saw that you have some in Washington, on some of the islands.
I do. I'm talking to bookshop and seeing if they have room and space for me and if I can come and do events there.
Okay, okay. And then are you already working on your next novel? It seems like every author I talk to is already onto their next thing.
Yes, that's in fact the best way to quell some of the nervousness about the build-up before a book comes out. You just
yeah.
pretend it's not happening and work on something else.
Right.
And I have a book that I've been working on for like, oh God, 3 years, and I can't get it right because it's just straight literary fiction. I don't think it's young adult. And it's about a family having a really awful Thanksgiving, so that should be fun.
Oh. So once
again, I have a dream that Oprah is going to be like, listen, if you have to go spend Thanksgiving at your in-laws, just take this book with you and lock yourself in the guest bathroom and you're going to be fine. Like, that's what I want to happen with this book.
That's your dream.
I want juicy family drama, and it's going to be awesome.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah. And so, okay, so then that probably won't come out for a while, but I will look for that. I will look for that on Oprah's Favorite Things or in her book club.
Excellent.
Yeah, I am so glad. So Nancy Fisher Richardson, another author I interviewed.
An amazing
yes,
writer. I'm so grateful to her for connecting you and I. This is wonderful.
She's so fun. Yeah, and I've been reading her book and I love it, her latest book. But yeah, I'm so glad that she connected us. So all you Northwest authors seem to really stick together. You seem to be all in the same, you know, the same club.
We do. I met Nancy at the we both kind of flew to the Northern California Independent Booksellers Conference,
okay.
And we both got to speak about our books, and her book, The Speed of Falling Objects,
yes.
is amazing, and I heard her talk about it, and Jesus, that book's right up my alley. It's gorgeous. I was
mm-hmm.
like, oh, she mentioned Shackleton. I thought, oh, we're best friends. It's amazing. Yeah, writing is so solitary. It's great to have people to cling to each other when we know our dumb stuff we're going through.
yeah, a bunch of like introverts who can be extroverts, but
who get
together.
We're forced to.
Yeah, if you're forced to. Yeah, it's funny that you were into acting, but yet you're like, oh, I hate doing this stuff. So
it's awful. And that
yeah.
was the thing about acting, because it wasn't me. You know, you could pretend to be someone else. You've got this costume and this makeup, and then you go backstage and you're like, I'm going home.
Yeah.
You guys go to Denny's. I'm not going with you.
I get it. I mean, I talk on, I anchor the morning show, and we're in there with the camera.
Yeah.
this, and I'm fine. I hate emceeing events, and I do it because we're, you know,
we're
supposed
really?
To. I hate getting up in front of people. Yeah, and people are like, well, you're in front of people all the time. And I say, no, I'm not. Those are cameras.
No, it's different.
Yeah, I mean, it does, and I'll do it.
Oh, makes me so sad. You're so brave.
Oh, no. I mean, it's just, well, I have to, right? I mean, it's part of the job, but it's just, I'm with you, though. I totally get that, you know, you're feeling
it's about weird.
That.
No, I think you're totally brave because, yeah, it's your job, but you could just fold and say, no, I'm not going to do it, and you...
Then I wouldn't
it.
Have a
and
job.
That is scary. Good for you. God.
Then they would
amazing.
Fire me. All right. Well, thank you again and have a great day. And we'll look for your book comes out January 21st, What I Carry. Thanks again, Jen.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Okay. Bye.
The Coin 6 Podcast Network is your home for all sorts of content you can't find anywhere else. Visit coin.com/coinpodcast to see our entire library. And you can always subscribe to all of the Coin 6 podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.